somebody says, does it break? And another board member says, it better break eventually.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied.
And now, here are your hosts, Aaron Dicer and Jeremy Scott.
You could have died.
It's not true.
Yes, it is. Quentin's brother died because he was walking in the same hallway.
It wasn't safe anywhere. Definitely wasn't your fault.
Then why have you been so mad at me?
Hello! Welcome, everybody. And I am on a different side of the screen than last week? I don't know. Oh, you sneaky, sneaky host. Welcome, chatters. Welcome, listeners. Today's big recommend, episode 75 of Recotopia, is The Fallout, the HBO Max original film. And it's a heavy one. I'm excited to get into it. But let's do some lighter stuff to start out the show with our usual small recommends. Aaron Dicer, my co-host. I'm Jeremy Scott. I keep screwing it up because I'm not used to being the lead on a podcast. Did you bring any small recommends this week, Aaron?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Oh, I sure did. As per the usual for me, one TV, one movie. We will start. Let's start with the TV show this week. New season of What We Do in the Shadows has started the first couple episodes. What's most impressive to me about this show, which I came to a little bit late, I think towards the end of season two, I caught up and started watching it because too many people had told me it's my kind of humor. Very, very funny stuff. And they were right. I really, really enjoy how funny this show is. I enjoy what it's doing. It is, at its essence, that thing where you take something that has been dark and scary and just create it as normal day-to-day, you know, satire slash humor. So vampires are now completely undermined by the fact that, you know, they have all the same foibles and, you know, weirdness and incompetence that a normal human may have. The show is basically vampires. They're just like us. Except for the extreme version of our own ignorance and stupidity. So it's been very, very fun in that way. But what I really love about it is the show's ability every season to kind of reinvent itself a little bit. Now, not so much that it changes what you love about the show, but with the ability to have this character have a different take on it. For instance, there's a character in the movie named Colin who's not a normal vampire. He's an emotional vampire. And his whole thing is that he sucks the life out of other people by being boring and dull and drab. And he's just that guy, you know. So then last season, they had this whole plot for him as he kind of went through some stuff. Guillermo kind of is the central figure of our attention in this season. So it kind of gives every character a chance to really kind of play in the spotlight out of the shadows, so
like
to speak.
Like Lost used to do with episodes, it's doing with seasons.
Sort of, yeah. I think that's fair to say. But really, really enjoying it. If you haven't watched any of What We Do in the Shadows, it is on Hulu. It's FX on Hulu. All the seasons are there. It's a quick watch, quick catch up, and it's a lot of fun.
I have not seen the movie or the show. Mm-hmm. And I have heard the same thing you have, that it is the kind of thing I would really enjoy. And I really have two lists of shame, one that I think I will actually get to and one that seems more
that's fair
impossible. And this is in the one that I think I'll get to, but you just pushed it a little bit further up the top.
All right, cool.
I'm sorry, soft drink fans. Both my small recommends this week are films. And I'm going to start out with a 2014 Draft Day starring Kevin Costner, Jennifer Garner, Chadwick Boseman, and Frank Langella. It's a 60 on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm curious to know the Chad and Aaron's opinion on this movie, because I can't tell you why I like it. I can't put my finger on it. It may simply be the mystique of Kevin Costner sports movies that always seem to be compelling. Maybe it's the inside baseball look at the draft process.
Inside football, but
inside
yes.
Inside football, yeah. I mean, it is kind of like a soap opera in the way the characters are drawn and interact. Everything is a big interaction, but I just really, really enjoyed it. I've seen it probably 7 or 8 times now. It was on last week, and I watched it again. I don't know. If you haven't seen it, give it a look. Give it 20 minutes. See if it does something for you. I get the feeling by his face that Aaron really doesn't like this movie. But maybe he's just smiling because...
Because that's what I do.
That's what he does. Have you seen this movie?
Yes, I've seen this movie a couple times. Really enjoyed it both times. I think what you're trying to put your finger on is the fact that it's one of those movies where if you separate yourself from your view of the movie, you can go from like a higher angle. You can go, I don't think this movie is like everything I usually like, or that it's, you know, that it's not exactly, you know, there are pieces that if I start to think about it fall apart or whatever the case may be. But when you're watching it, you find yourself invested in the performances, the characters, and the plot. And really, if a movie can get you invested in the performances, the characters, and the plot, you're probably going to have a good time. And that other stuff can kind of flow away. I think this movie ends really well. I it's ridiculous, but how many movies do I love that have ridiculous endings? And this is, you know, one of them that I like that has a ridiculous ending.
It's like the screenwriter said, how many first round picks do you think somebody would actually trade in an extreme scenario? And then he added another one. It's absurd. Everything about the trades is completely absurd.
Right.
But I do love the manipulation between the GMs. They're all trying to manipulate each other. And Costner just carries himself in a way that when he owns them at the end, you really want to cheer. I agree. I think it ends really well. Anyway, draft day right now, if you wanted to watch it, it's on Max, HBO Max. I really don't like calling that Max. But I guess eventually I'll get used to it.
Go with the full title, Max, the place for HBO.
Is that really what it is?
I don't know.
Oh, my goodness.
I've heard that joke made.
Do you have a second small recommend this week, sir?
I do. And before we get there, shout out to the chat who is looking up my letterbox scores for all the movies we talk about.
Nice.
So they can compare. I gave Draft Day a 3 out of 5, which is in the
that
positive.
Seems fair.
But just barely. So yeah, there you go.
That's funny. Like this has become a thing now.
Right.
I'm never going to have a letterbox.
All right. Let's head on to my movie small recommend for the week. And that is Asteroid City. Speaking of things you're never going to like or never going to do, Jeremy and I have had recent conversations about Wes Anderson, which is how I know this. I've heard this movie described as the most Wes Andersoniest movie to ever Wes Anderson. I disagree fully with that observation. I actually think that's French Dispatch. I actually think French Dispatch is like the most he's ever been that definition of himself. This movie feels a little different for me in that I feel like he's taking what he's done with kind of how he structured his recent movies, where, like, you know, French Dispatch was a magazine, and, you know, Grand Budapest Hotel was a book, and, like, you know, there's these underlying structures that he's added. In this one, that underlying structure is a little bit deeper ingrained into the storytelling in a way that it almost feels like Wes Anderson directed a Charlie Kaufman movie.
Oh, wow.
At times, which I found not only fascinating, but really interesting and pleasurable to watch. There are moments where there are characters, I don't think this is too spoilery because I'll kind of talk around it, but there are characters who have been cut from the movie that had scenes cut from the movie that are telling other characters about the scene they had cut from the movie. And it's so interesting because it's this layer of having somebody talk about a character's emotion instead of actually emoting it, which when you really think about it is kind of what Wes Anderson characters usually do. They're not really emoting a lot. They're just kind of saying the words. And I think he's found a really interesting way to let the emotion of a story exist because of the factual information and not necessarily the the exaggeration or exorbitance of the performance, which I find really, really interesting. So Asteroid City, I really enjoyed. One of my favorite Wes Andersons. It's insane to me how after Fantastic Mr. Fox, I've really kind of liked everything he's done. I think I've grown into enjoying his style, maybe. Mm. And before Fantastic Mr. Fox, I just haven't been on board. So I wonder if I need to go revisit some of his earlier stuff. But
I just want more Rushmore stuff, man. Not only is that my favorite Wes Anderson movie, but that's one of my favorite movies.
And well, it's certainly his most accessible movie, I would think.
That's what I'm saying. I want more straightforward stuff. The characters are a little quirky, but it feels like the real world. And then everything he's made since then feels like it's not in the real world.
And correct. And I like that.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
Well, and I think there's a freshness to it for me is why I like it too. Like, you know, he is almost the opposite of trying for immersion, right? Like he's thrown immersion out the door and is going, I'm doing something different. And so to be able to find meaning and emotion in non-immersion is, I think, a really interesting experiment, and it works for me. But I know it doesn't work for everybody. So Asteroid City is my second small recommend.
All right. I've heard good things about this, and I think it's probably going to be good for the people who like Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when I'll get to this. I think I told you in our other conversation
it's in that second list.
It is in the second list because I have just kind of stopped watching those movies. All right. My second small recommend this week, another film that I watched last week, 2011, The Gray, starring Liam Neeson. This is on one of the movie channels because it says with a premium subscription on Hulu, Roku, or Amazon, you could watch it. That usually means it's on Showtime or Cinemax or something. The Gray is one of the most straightforwardly plotted movies I've ever loved watching. What if a plane crashed in the absolute wilderness of Alaska, British Columbia, who knows where they are? And a pack of wolves decided to pursue the survivors of the plane crash. That's the plot of the movie from beginning to end. There is a mild trigger warning in the beginning. Liam Neeson's character, his wife has died, and he is the sharpshooter at an oil facility. He kills the wolves that approach the facility and endanger people that work there. And he sticks his gun in his mouth, but he does not pull the trigger. But that can still be triggering to people. So I wanted to let that out there. But it's basically what if Taken was in the wilderness against wolves instead of Romanian gangsters or whoever they are in Taken. And there's some pretty good solid performances from people you don't necessarily see a lot in movies like this. Dermot Mulroney is in this. Frank Grillo, who has been in some Marvel movies and is in Warriors, doesn't often get a chance to show his dramatic side because he's so good at action. And this has one of my favorite endings of all time in movies. And I don't really want to spoil it, even though it's a 12-year-old movie. But he may or may not fight a wolf one-on-one with broken glass between his knuckles. Anyway, The Gray. That's my second small recommend. You're familiar with this movie. I'm sure
I love this movie. I think it's a great movie. And I think you're almost selling it short because I actually think there's a really powerful message in this movie about survival. And about why we decide to survive, like why we fight to survive. What is that survival instinct? What does it mean to us? What is valuable in there? What's not valuable in there? And you mentioned in comparison to Taken a little bit, the difference with this and Taken is the idea of fighting for someone else, for someone we love. And then this is the idea of why do we fight for ourselves? Why do we, you know, what does survival look like?
There's even a character near the end who just gives up. He just says, I'm done.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This movie is very intentionally showing us different ways human beings decide to fight or decide not to fight for survival. And I think it's a really powerful movie. So, yeah, I think it's well done. I think Liam Neeson's incredible in it. So
yeah, he is. Has one of the favorite lines that we overused in early Sins videos where he says something about over a billfold. Because somebody tries to steal a dead person's wallet, and he says, "This Liam Neeson, I'll make you bleed out your ear." I don't remember what he says. All right, guys, it's time for this week's big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so
big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The fallout on Max, I watched this last night, and it was my second viewing, and it was my second time being gutted like a fish emotionally. I know some of you didn't make it through this movie from what I was seeing on Discord, and I understand that absolutely. I did intentionally wait until summertime to discuss this movie so that nobody would have to send their kids to school.
Sure.
I think it's would be even harder to watch in the school year. But this movie centers basically on Veda. She's a regular high school girl. She's 16, and she goes to school one day. It's an absolutely normal day, and her little sister calls her and tells her that she's gotten her period. And it's kind of a sweet little conversation between sisters that you can tell right away that they have a pretty good relationship. But she got excused from class to go to the bathroom, quote unquote, to take that call. And she looks up at the bathroom and decides, yeah, I might as well pee while I'm here. She doesn't say that, but she decides to go into the bathroom. In the bathroom is the prototypical, really popular girl in school, Mia, who does dance videos on TikTok or Instagram or something, and who has two dads who are very rich and gone all the time. We don't learn all that right away, but they are both in this bathroom when the sound of gunfire erupts from the hallway, and it is harrowing. We spend the entire attack in this bathroom hearing the screaming, the running, the banging, the gunshots. They hide in a stall together. At one point, somebody runs into the bathroom and they freak out. And he immediately says, I'm not the shooter. And it's Quentin, a classmate. And he comes into the stall and hides with them and tells them that his brother has just been shot in the hallway outside. And it's a lot to take in. It's really hard to watch because this is happening regularly in this country and only this country. Initially, Veda's family seems more impacted than her because she just goes to a dead emotional place instantly. She just suppresses things. And it's clear that this is a loving family. Later on in the movie, she will admit, my parents are good parents. I should probably be nicer to them. But I can't imagine what this would feel like emotionally to go through. But she starts watching Mia's videos on Instagram. And Mia eventually invites her over because, as the movie will show you, they are forever bonded because of this experience together. There's no one who went through what they went through together other than Quentin. And they oddly bond pretty easily and quickly. And they find that they can make each other smile, share some of the same. Like she says, Veda says, you have like terrible nightmares. And Mia sadly says, you have to be able to sleep to have nightmares. They decide to go to the funeral of Quentin's little brother. And then there's a really powerful scene where we see Veda put the funeral program or bulletin in a box. And then we just see her keep putting more and more and more. I think that said, I don't remember the number of students that were killed in that attack. But it's really sobering. One of the things this movie does extremely well is show you how the trauma grows after an event. And it's not just, oh, you survived a school shooting. That must have been rough. It's also, you had to go to all these funerals and think about this over and over again. Your family is impacted in ways that personally from the outside, you know, other people wouldn't be able to know. Her little sister is trying so hard to connect to her and see life in her again, and it doesn't work. This actress playing the younger sister, this time through the movie, I realized how incredible she is. She doesn't have anywhere near the dialogue to convey what she conveys. She does it with her eyes, and it's just amazing. So Veda starts hanging out more with Mia. There's casual alcohol and drug use in this movie, which I think makes sense for people who have been through a traumatic event like this and have no parental supervision when they're at Mia's house. She does not go to her friend Nick's march. Nick is her friend we see early on in the beginning, and his reaction to this shooting has been to become an activist. And he stages a gun control march and gives a speech, and she's skipping it to hang out with Mia and drink wine. Later on, when she tries to watch that speech on YouTube, she can't even finish it. She's no place to do any activism right now because she still hasn't dealt, you know, with any of the emotions from this trauma. So her parents decide, if we're not going to go to school, we want you to at least go see a therapist. And we get a nice, lovely Shailene Woodley role here where she plays the therapist. And I want to take a moment to praise how the movie handles therapy, both in how the first interaction goes, where Veda is closed off and intentionally giving silly, jokey answers. She's not participating at all in this process. And then the session we see at the end of the movie where she has participated in this process and has seen growth. The only caveat to my praising the therapy in this movie is that it shows a breakthrough session on the second session ever. And that's not realistic to expect if you have trauma and you go to therapy. It's going to take more than two sessions, but I think the scenes themselves, from my experience in doing therapy, are really, really well done. And I think viewers will come away thinking therapy is less scary because of how it's portrayed. Again, Shailene Woodley does a really, really good job with this. This movie does a couple of things that Roma does. That's my new favorite thing, where it shows us in one shot somebody having joy and somebody having pain. There's this shot where her little sister's in the background setting up her phone, trying to get this TikTok dance down perfect, oblivious to the fact that Veda's over here texting a friend about how many funerals they've been to in the last week. And it's just powerful to me because we often don't know what somebody's going through, even when we love them and live in the same house as them. We don't always know. They dabble in weed, which is a fairly funny scene, but it's also haunting. It's hard for me to laugh at some of this stuff because, like, later on she takes ecstasy, and I don't think I'm necessarily supposed to laugh, but it is played like a typical comedy would play it, where she slides down the stairs while she's on E, or she falls into the pool and she's stoned. I think we're supposed to also remember that this is a coping mechanism and it's in no way a healthy one. And she dangerously goes weed, marijuana, ecstasy in a really fast amount of time. Anyway, she ends up sending Quentin some crazy texts when she is on ecstasy. He tells her the next day. So they decide, she invites him over to watch a movie. And there's another thing the movie does really well here that it doesn't spell everything out for you. They're watching a movie. They're having fun. And Quentin suddenly says, I got to go. He gets a text on his phone. He's like, family stuff. And I don't think the movie explains that anymore. He just goes. And she's like, okay, yeah, don't think anything about it. Quentin is here to remind us that people need time after an event like this. Later on, she will try to kiss him. And I think he clearly likes her. But he says, no place to be in a relationship right now. She sadly takes that personally. It's hard not to feel rejected when you kiss somebody and they say, I don't really want to do this. She also has a fling with Mia one night where the movie doesn't show you anything but them kissing, but later on she will say they had sex. And again, I think kids that are 16 are already exploring love and those emotions and attraction. And I think a trauma event like what they've been through, which bonds them so tight, so fast, I think it would leave her searching how to express those, how to feel those, how to live with these positive feelings that in this negative time. Throughout a lot of this, her friend Nick is texting her, calling her. This is the guy that organizes the marches, and she's not responding to him. And the night that they have sex, she stays at Mia's and comes home hungover the next morning, and Nick had already called her parents because he was worried about her. She goes to Nick's house and says, you didn't have to rat on me, dude. And I'm glad that Nick gets a moment to put her in her place and explain that, you know, he was genuinely concerned that she might not be safe. She starts ignoring texts from Mia at this point, because she's embarrassed. She doesn't know if she should be embarrassed about the tryst. And then we get to the scene that breaks me, where Amelia, Veda's little sister, comes into her room at night and curls up in bed next to her. And she says that she knows she's to blame for Veda almost dying because of the timing of her texts about her period that day at school. And Veda says, no, you're not to blame. And Amelia says, then why have you been so mad at me? And I had to pause it for a good 10 minutes and be emotional and just experience that, because through her eyes, you now see every other interaction from the beginning of the movie through Amelia's eyes. And you realize that trauma breeds trauma, and it grows like a weed and infects the people close to you. The scene ends lovely, though, because Amelia says, you were the first person I thought of in that moment. You're my favorite person in the whole world, and you always will be, even after I get married. And it's a lovely scene that really sets the tone and begins the healing for her. Her dad then takes her to a hilltop, and they do that thing that happens in movies where you're convinced to scream out loud all your troubles, and he doesn't care if she swears. And they both say some pretty honest stuff, screaming into the wind. And then we see her back at therapy, and now she has begun to feel her emotions. She's allowed herself to experience them, ups and downs, and this is the first step to healing. But then the final scene reminds you that healing is a really long process. She goes to Mia's dance studio because they've reconciled and they're going to meet up. And she's clearly excited. And a news alert comes across her phone about a school shooting in Ohio and 12 kids are dead. And Veda has a panic attack. And we only hear most of it. And then the movie ends, because that's reality. The movie doesn't sugarcoat anything. The movie is just showing us our country as it exists right now. And what's wild is that in the movie that's, what, 2 years old? That's like a month and a half between those two shootings. And in real life, now, sometimes there's not even days between school shootings in America. And I feel like the movie deserves a bigger audience because it could change some minds. Minds that don't currently have the empathy for students and their families who have this fear every single day. I have a lot of notes that I want to get to and point out certain moments, but that's my recap. Aaron, how do you feel about The Fallout?
I really, really like this movie. I had written down many of the things that you've already touched on, whether it be the scene with the sister, which, by the way, is set up perfectly in that first phone call. It is one of the sweetest sister, like older sister, younger sister conversations I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it felt authentic, like so much of this movie does. I feel like this movie feels very authentic. The relationship between the two girls, by the way, one of whom Jenna Ortega has a lot of the heat in this, after this doing Wednesday and so many other things. Maddie Ziegler is the other girl, and I found it really interesting in that she says some things that kind of apply to her own life. There was something about, being in dance from a young age, and then at one point, I think Veda says something about, I'll be your stage mom or whatever. Well, she got her start on, Dance Moms. Literally, Dance Moms was the show where Maddie Ziegler came to prominence. And then she was in, I became more aware of her. I didn't watch that show, but I became more aware of her when she started being in, was it Sia? I think it was either Sia or Gaga. I think it was Sia had a lot of videos, and Maddie Ziegler was always kind of the dancing stand-in for Sia. Just some incredible stuff. She's an incredible dancer. She really is. And I think she's doing good acting work here as well. So that was really, really interesting to see.
Yeah.
You mentioned the TikTok going on in the background. I definitely had that noted. It's such a beautiful way and the movie does this often, where it visualizes how others are trying to interact around you, but you just are in your own space, your own world, your own trauma, and I think the movie does that really, really well. The fact that this is it Megan Park, I think, directed this. It's a directorial debut, kind of blew my mind. It's really good work. Like, it's a real, not only understanding of how to tell a story, which there is a story being told here, but even more has this clear understanding of what it's trying to do. And the only negatives I had for this movie were intentional. Like, the things that I, like, didn't necessarily connect to or didn't like about it, I felt, and I'll just briefly express those. I like a movie that's a little more willing to get deep and underneath the stuff. And this movie doesn't do that in the same way that I usually experience it, which is like these heavy dialogue scenes really like the therapy sessions are beautiful. I loved the therapy sessions in this movie. I thought they were a real good example, but those are prime opportunities for what another movie might do, which is to really let her dig in and have a deep catharsis about what's, you know, been going on. In this movie, very purposefully and intentionally doesn't want to do that, because what it's saying is that this is a lifelong process, that this isn't solved in a day, that this isn't, in fact, the ending is the biggest example of this, you know, saying that this is something that does not have that big catharsis. Oh, you know, okay, here's, you know, how everything is okay. And I didn't expect the movie to say everything was okay, but there were times I was feeling a little bit of like, I want to go deeper. I want to explore what she's feeling a little bit more instead of just experiencing it. But that's not what the movie wants. The movie wants you to just experience it. And I think that's valuable. I think that's really interesting and valuable. I thought it was really well done. There's plenty of other things. I want to bring up another one that you brought up was the swearing scene with the dad. I thought it was so amazing when she was like, "Dad, we're not even swearing anymore." Yeah. I thought that was so cool. Yeah. Because that was never really the point. The point was really to say the things you're feeling. And I thought that was really beautiful. One example of things the movie doesn't ever delve into, because it doesn't feel like it has to, is where are Maddie Ziegler's dads? Like we never meet them. Never hear like, you know, we know they're in Europe, I guess, but we don't really hear, like, did they know what happened? We don't even know if they know what happened. And I think the movie is purposefully, again, having us experience things from Veda's, you know, perspective.
It's the opposite end of the spectrum, right? Veda's parents are loving, and they're there, they're present, but they don't know what to do. And Mia's parents aren't even there. That's like, her trauma is going to be a lot worse because of that.
But I kind of wanted at least a one line of dialogue that was here's what they said about it, and can you believe they were that callous?
They're at the NATO summit. They can't leave. Something like that.
Yeah, like this something that even allows us to draw that distinction even greater, because their voice is missing, whatever that voice is, and so it's just a lot of interpretation. But again, I think that's intentional. So like, I don't have a huge problem with it. But I was curious about it. I have plenty other I can talk to, but you talk about. But go ahead, you pull something out.
The movie expects you to pay attention, I think, to get the full effect. And there are two moments I'm going to talk about that underline that. When she goes to take the phone call, and she's outside in the hallway about to go into the bathroom, there is a backpacked, hooded student that walks behind her, and I'm pretty sure that's the shooter. Because it's not very long before the shooting starts after that. And I didn't notice that the first time through because I didn't know it was about to happen. The other moment is halfway through the film when Julie Bowen, her mother, is trying to get her to go to therapy or have that conversation. She says something and Veda says, "Oh, I already did that." And her mom says, "Well, what would I do without you?" And the camera pans to Veda's face as she processes that phrase is never going to be the same to me now because I could have been gone.
There's
no dialogue about it. It's only an eye lift. She looks up from her phone when her mom says that, but I feel like the movie is being very intentional there, saying this is just one of the millions of ways this trauma is going to impact the rest of their lives. My first note, all hail the 90-minute movie.
Sure.
Because we don't get enough of those. I think the panic and anxiety stuff portrayed in this movie is really well done. And I think it's actually unsettling more at the end that we can't see her. We can only hear her. But those felt like they were written by somebody who's had those experiences. She's waking up with nightmares, doing panic breathing. There's a lot about this movie, mental health wise, that it just gets right. I love the line where she's doing that whole spiel. She's stoned, but she ends with, "Can I trust this meme?" it's a very funny rant.
The movie is not without humor.
No,
it doesn't lead humor. With it at all, but it allows it to be part of coping mechanisms.
Yeah, exactly. That is life. Like the other day, Friday, I had an all-timer of a bad day, but it was just because a bunch of different stuff went wrong, all coincidentally. And I'm angry. I'm stomping around the house. My wife is not talking to me because she knows that I'm not in a good conversation place.
Right.
And something on the TV, I think it was Friends. I think it was something Joey said. And I laughed. And my brain went, why are you laughing? You're angry. but it's just, it's a human impulsive response to life. And that's what the movie lets you feel, all of the emotions.
Well, it's definitely a both things can be true kind of movie. Like it definitely plays in that ground of, you know, the things that we think are contradictory. We need to kind of get over this. There have been literal cases that have put people away in jail because they didn't seem sad enough about a traumatic event or whatever. And I think we are so predisposed by media to like, this is how you're supposed to react to trauma. And we just need to understand there are so many different ways that people react to trauma. And
this movie gives you a few, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Mia's drinking. Quentin is kind of being mature and responsible emotionally. Veda's, you know, suppressing all of her emotions.
That denial stage stuff is really interesting to me when Veda's in the denial stage. It's one of those things where I think it kind of comes to a head where she won't use the restroom at school when she goes back, and she steps on a can and it shocks her so much that she pees herself. And it is one of the most, like, up until that point, she's been really trying to convince herself she's okay. And I feel like even at that point, even having done all that, she's still desperately trying to be okay.
Yep.
Instead of like really dealing with, and I don't know that I've ever seen that so clearly, that idea of, you know, even confronted with how obvious it is that I am not okay, I'm going to ignore it. You know, I'm going to continue to be in denial about it. I thought it was really powerful and led to some interesting stuff later. So
first day back at school, the first day she goes back to school, what are they doing? Active shooter training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course she couldn't use the bathroom. The school mm-hmm. itself won't let her forget it. I have places that exist in the world that I won't go to right now because they're associated with some kind of trauma. And that was very believable to me. She got all the way to the door. She thought she was okay. She thought she could do it. And she just couldn't go through that door.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Do we have a super secret double feature this week? Aaron.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
So I've been kind of paying attention to some of the choices that the chat's been throwing out for the double feature. I like all those choices. I thought about some of them. Mass was one I definitely thought about. Certainly topic-wise, it deals with the same kind of thing. I saw that mentioned, but nobody I thought mentioned this one, and I just feel like this is kind of perfect. I think the double feature for this is Ordinary People. I think this has that same idea of trauma in an authentic family and how you deal with it and how you don't deal with it. And I was blown away by this movie when I saw it. For many of the same reasons I enjoy The Fallout. And it has to do with how authentically it portrays grief and trauma. So, Jeremy, have you seen this one?
I have, yeah. In fact, it was my super secret double feature for The Artifice Girl.
Oh.
I actually gave two that day, but that was one of them.
That's right.
And you're right. In terms of traumatic themes... and how they impact the family and how they impact people differently. Mm-hmm. Everybody should watch Ordinary People. It's way ahead of its time in terms of mental health and therapy mm-hmm. and treating that
And that was the other part. The therapy stuff was the other part, the reason I really thought of this movie. And I think it's Timothy Hutton that kind of is the stand-in for our character for this one who goes through a lot of the stuff. But you've got the parent stuff that's in mm-hmm. This one. There's some very interesting similarities, although not identical, between the moms in these two movies. By the way, I thought the scene where she opened up and was completely honest with her mom. She has a scene with everybody in the family in the fallout, but the scene where she was honest with her mom and her reaction to that was really, really great.
It was with the girls, so I can't get pregnant at least. She walks out of the room. This movie, I kept thinking about Spontaneous while I was watching this movie. Spontaneous is, I think, sort of an allegory for school shootings and how we process that trauma. It plays much more into the horror humor angle, so it may be too jarring to be a double feature, but it did remind me of that movie several times throughout.
There was one other thing I did want to mention before we move on. There are so many little touches in the fallout, and I just wanted to mention a couple of them.
Okay.
One of them is when she's goes to visit her new friend for the first time, Mia, for the first time, and Mia's waiting by the door. But when she knocks, Mia like takes a couple steps as if she wasn't waiting by the door, like consciously doesn't want to appear, you know, too eager or whatever. Yeah. There's like all these little touches like that. At one point, they're making fun of each other for the things they're saying. She's like, "Did you just say stoner thoughts?" And I don't know why that made me laugh so much. And just the little sister's initial, like, no chill reactions at the dinner table, like right after it's happened, and the little sister is just like cracking, you know, like questions and jokes, and just like literally has no idea how to interact with trauma because she's so young. I just thought all that stuff was handled really, really well. So I wanted to throw that out there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, and I don't necessarily want to find out, but somebody associated with this movie has probably been through a trauma very similar to the one that happens in this movie. Because it is also very authentic. All right, Aaron, you are the picker for the next week's homework. What movie are we going to be watching?
You can pick your movies and you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your friend's movies. I'm going with Double Indemnity for our big recommend next week. This is a big time classic. If you want to go back in time, we're going back in time. This is, man, 1944, I think. So what, like 80 years ago?
Wow.
It is an incredible film, though. Really one of the first of that, you know, noir genre that's been done over and over again, parodied many of times. But there's something really special about this movie. Barbara Stanwyck. Fred McMurray, if you only know Fred McMurray from Disney movies, get ready, because he was actually a legit amazing actor before he was an admittedly amazing actor in the Disney movies as well. Some really good stuff here. Excited to go over this one with you. Have you seen it before?
I have not. One of my greatest joys about this show is that it forces me to watch movies that are on either of my stacks of shame. When I might otherwise look at that stack and see Friends on the TV and just keep playing Friends on the TV. So this is going to be the fourth or fifth, maybe even sixth movie on Wreckatopia that I have not seen prior to the show. And that is just me mirroring what we hope the audience is experiencing with this show, is that being exposed to a film that you haven't seen before that has good quality. This one appears to be only available to rent or buy.
Yes.
Which is okay. We're not always going to land on a movie that is free to stream. I'm excited. Porter Hall's in this. He's in something else that I just watched, but he's in Miracle on 34th Street.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I like that. Double Indemnity, noir, crime, and it's an hour and 47 minutes. All hail the 90 to 110 minute
107
movie.
Minute movie. All hail the 107 minute movie.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes to get to a couple of questions.
Right
so
on.
When there, the chat has devolved into more Sin City talk. let's do some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
If we ever get that choreography movement category at the Oscars, what would be the first scenes you think of?
First of all, let me just say, adding categories to the Oscars should have happened five years ago at least. Like, it's ridiculous that they continue to be stubborn when they changed the categories. They combined the sound categories a while ago. Like, what are we being so precious about?
Yep.
And by the way, this category existed before at the Oscars. They actually got rid of it at one point.
Yeah.
So I am fully for adding stunt, choreography, whatever kind of categories. As far as this specific question, What would be the first scenes I think of? The entirety of the movie RRR, but especially the Natu Natu dance scene, is absolutely astounding. But even the action stuff would fit into this idea of choreography. The way that movie is choreographed is insane. So that's the first thing that came to my mind as a movie deserving of this category.
Well, I'm similar. My first, very first thought was 1917. Even though it's not technically a one shot, there is so much performance that is based on movement and choreography to pull those emotions out of you, particularly that shot, that famous shot where the camera's pulling back as the guy runs at you and the soldiers are all going past him. And I also thought of Mission Impossible 6, or I guess now 7. I haven't seen it yet, but I said all year after number 6 that McQuarrie deserved a Best Director nomination because just the scope of that spectacle and pulling that off. And, you know, Tom Cruise would probably end up winning. If they ever do a stuntman category, you know what's going to happen? Tom Cruise will get nominated because he does his own stunts and he'll win over an actual stuntman.
They would give it to the stunt coordinator, actually. I think it would be for the entire movie for stunts. Like, it wouldn't be necessarily like best individual stunt or best stunt performer. It would be, you know, like casting or makeup, like where it's like the person who's in charge of that would win the Oscar for that.
Interesting. All right.
I would guess.
I bet Tom Cruise would still find a way to do that. What is your favorite throwaway line?
I immediately thought of the Hudsucker proxy for this category, and it could be a million different lines from the Hudsucker proxy. The board member, when they're talking about the hula hoop and their, you know, his idea for it, one of the board members just says, like, in the midst of this cacophony of questions, like, somebody says, "Does it break?" And another board member says, "It better break eventually." When the stuff that Buzz says on the elevator in that movie, when he's doing like the rhyming, and he's rhyming everybody's name with the floor that they want to go to. And he's like, you know, Mr. Levin, 47. He's like, actually 46. He's like, walk down. Because like the rhyming is more important than actually what floor he needs to go to. The time where Amy Archer is like, "A face that only a mother could love." And then the throwaway line, "On payday," just slays me. That movie has such great throwaway stuff. It's beautiful.
It really does. Yeah. It's like a throwback to those really talky movies. I'm going to go with Batman Begins. Probably my favorite line in the entire trilogy is when we go to the docks where Batman will eventually attack the drug workers and put the mob guy on the spotlight. The mob guy's in the car with the crooked cop, and the crooked cop asks him, you know, "Where are these drugs going?" or whatever, and the mob boss goes, "Don't burden yourself with the secrets of scary people." Nolan has, I guess his brother probably wrote these scripts, but in the next movie in Dark Knight, Eric Roberts does the same kind of thing when he's in the nightclub, Batman is attacking, and the pretty girl goes, "We can't hear you talk." And he goes, "What makes you think I want to hear you talk?" Yeah, I like that question. We could probably come back to that question. The chat has some good ones. No Ticket, "I'm Hungry, Let's Get a Taco." Those are both from Slab. "Sarcasm is a foreign language to you, isn't it?" Lion King 1.5.
That's a great movie, by the way. That's an underrated gem, The Lion King 1.5. It may just be because I watched it with my boys all the time when they were growing up, but yeah.
Interesting. Fun stuff. I've not seen that one. Yeah. I also see The World's End. Martin Freeman finally says, "What the fuck?" And Simon Pegg follows up with, "What the fuck?" And somehow I was just reminded of Mission Impossible 4 when Tom Cruise is trying to get back to the hotel room and Jeremy Renner's standing in the hotel room and goes, "Rope's not long enough." Tom Cruise goes, "No shit." All right, one more question, and then I'm going to get a sandwich. Name a movie-going experience where something happened in the physical auditorium around you that resulted in you either missing some of the film or kept you from fully immersing and enjoying it.
When I went to see Tim Burton's Dumbo, in the finale scene, the big finale of Dumbo, where the circus is getting destroyed and, you know, Dumbo's flying and all that, the pre-roll advertisements started. And it's interesting because it was one of those screens that has the consecutive cameras, right? It uses two cameras to shoot. And so one of the cameras was still playing the Dumbo finale. The other was playing the pre-roll advertisements. So they were like over each other. And it was very distracting. But somehow made that movie better. You know, like it's just one of those things. Also, what happened during that, they shut everything down, tried to like reboot it. And when everything was shut down, they still had the projector lights. There was just, you know, nothing like a static image on the screen. And so I did shadow puppets for the kids nice. In the auditorium because I was in the back row. So I'm tall enough. So I stood up and did shadow puppets while they were trying to get
you
things.
Just reminded me of a time that Josh Childs and I went on a triple date to see Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Uh-huh.
And we convinced Josh to go up to the front. It was a sold out show. And so Josh went up to the front of the auditorium to do trivia. And he asked, does anybody know what sitcom Leonardo DiCaprio was on? And somebody goes, somebody yelled, whichever one it was.
Growing Pains.
Yeah, somebody yells, Growing Pains, sit down! And he basically came back with his head. But that was before the movie started.
Amazing.
I was a guitar player in a wedding in Detroit, Michigan, in college. And was otherwise not very familiar with most of the people. And so after the rehearsal on the dinner, I decided to see a movie, and I went to I Know What You Did Last Summer. I still know what you did last summer. Sold out show, Friday night, and a knife fight broke out on the other side of the auditorium, prompting me to leave and go back to the hotel and be thankful that I was alive. Those are probably the biggest ones. I do want to tell one story. It's not a movie auditorium. It was my sixth grade classroom when the teacher was showing us Camelot, which is not a movie you should show children who are sixth graders. And it was never shown to sixth grade again. And there's a romantic scene where a man nuzzles some bosoms and a kid in the back row stands up and yells, bury it. And he got suspended, and I have never forgotten that instant.
My goodness.
It's exactly what a sixth grader would say in that instance, and not an actual person.
Amazing.
All right, thank you everybody in the chat. We appreciate your input and your lively commentary, even when it devolves into Sin City talk. let's see, a couple here I want to pull out real quick. When I saw Pacific Rim 2, I had to tell three teenagers to stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
When I turn around, the dude is taking off his shirt and the other two are taking pictures of him. That is frightening. That escalated quickly. I was watching Guy Ritchie's The Covenant and my mom called. The film burned when I saw The Master and Harry Potter, The Half-Blood Prince. Yeah, film burns are no fun. Group of people behind me at The Grudge screamed all five times the ghost boy was outside the elevator window. Yeah, I can't watch horror movies with a live audience. It's just impossible. All right, everybody. Double Indemnity is your homework next week. And we will be at the usual day and time. And I hope everybody has a great day and great rest of your week. We'll see you next time.
All right. See you then. Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up? Hosty host, host with the most.
I love how it says the host may add you to the broadcast at any time. Be ready.
But be ready.
Not guaranteed.
You never know what that crazy host is going to do.
You never knew. Never knew.
Never knew.
Never nude.
I had vague memories of Arrested Development when we were in Vegas when we went to see the Blue Man Group. Because
he tries to be part of the Blue Man Group.
Yeah, he blued himself.
We gotta go back, Kate. We gotta go back. There's a show I can't go back to. Have you gone back to Lost?
Oh, heck yeah.
Really? How do you get through the filler episodes where background people suddenly have their whole story told. Like, that stuff would drive me crazy.
Yeah, certainly. It's crazy drivable. It's really clear that they were flailing. Like, during those times where they're like, we know where we want to go, and we don't have the control to go ahead and get there because the studio doesn't want to let this show die. Yeah, it was a groundbreaking show for letting the creator decide how many seasons to do. Like, before that, you know, the studios just would milk their shows as long
as they
could.
Now it's much more common, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Vince Gilligan did Better Call Saul exactly as long as he wanted to, and then just turned it off.
Yep.
Yeah, those days are probably over, though. That's probably not going to last too much longer.
I don't know, man. There's a place for both serialized content, which is where we've moved primarily to. Like, when you think of prestige TV, it's about these shows that have overarching themes for their characters. They're basically, you know, long movies, like really, really long movies. But there is a place for just, like, I like hanging out with these people. Like, I don't need to know, like, every episode doesn't have to deal with some deep thing they're going through or connect to their story arc or tell some greater mystery or story. Just what's their adventure this week? You know, Seinfeld is a primary example of a show that was proud to be about nothing, which is, it's just like, I like being with these people and seeing what funny things happen when they're together, you know? And it's like, we don't have a ton of that anymore. And I think it's needed, you know?
How many more of these are they going to make? Have they made an action movie that was great?
It's Netflix?
Yes. I'm talking like, okay, I gave them Underground, Six Underground. Uh-huh. And I gave them another one that I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen any raving reviews about the films being great. I think I've seen negative reviews for almost every Netflix action movie except the Extraction ones. And even those reviews are praising the action or the one shot, not necessarily the film.
I would say you're looking at, did you ever watch Triple Frontier?
Yes. Yes. But for various reasons, I don't remember it.
Okay.
And that's probably the best one from what I know.
I know it has its detractors. I really enjoyed it. I think it's really clever and interesting and fun.
They did that one with The Rock and Gal Gadot and Ryan Reynolds globetrotting. That was supposed to be terrible.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
So I just feel like this is
Was important. The Harder They Fall, was that Netflix?
Yes, but I would probably call that Western.
Yeah, but it's definitely Western action. I mean, you know, like, it's
yes, and that movie's great. So thanks for sinking my ship.
Gunpowder Milkshake was another one. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
Gunpowder Milkshake feels like a name of a movie I would recognize.
It does. Oh, there are press screenings, Jeremy. I just don't live in a market big enough for them to care to give me press screenings. My nearest press screenings are 3 hours away. I get invites, but I'm not driving 6 hours round trip.
So even the Mission Impossible one you went to, you drove 3 hours for that?
No, the Mission Impossible one, I was in Nashville. So I was able to say, hey, I'm going to be in Nashville.
And we're a bigger market.
And you have press screenings in Nashville. We just don't have press screenings.
I didn't realize that. Well, you need to move.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's settled then. I'll let my wife and my kids know. And we'll be heading somewhere. Somewhere who does press screenings.
There's an arc on Friends, which is happening right now on my screen, where Ross marries this English woman.
I love that you've got Friends on right now while we're recording. That's amazing.
Friends is always on in the background until Seinfeld comes on a different channel. But Ross marries this English woman, and it's like rapid. He's known her for days or what have you. And then they end up, you know, breaking up and divorcing, and Ross doesn't know what to do. And he's like, I need advice. And Joey goes, if you want my advice, you're not going to like it. You got married too fast. Oh, man. I love Friends, even though it's so problematic. It just gets worse, though.
The longer we go, the more
the better I become as a human. The worse
right, yeah. The more well, I think even more than us, particularly as humans, I think culture continues to evolve and figure out, you know, how we've been terrible and, you know,
like I want to recommend Wonder Boys on this show eventually with Michael Douglas. I think it's a fantastic movie, but there's pretty careless treatment verbally of a transgender person in that movie. And they use a term that I'm pretty sure is a slur. Mm-hmm. And when that movie came out in the early aughts, you know, culture had not matured enough to see that and call it out. Anyway, well, one of those things where if I recommend it, I'm going to have to do a caveat of some sort.
Yeah, it's always interesting how to balance that stuff. I think, you know, for culture, it's so difficult to grow sometimes because privilege does two things, right? The privilege allows people in power not to realize that something is hurtful because it's not hurtful to them, right? So if it's not hurtful to me, I'm not necessarily feeling the impact of something that's hurtful to somebody else. And so it allows for sustained ignorance, right? And then simultaneously, it also allows for those to be the people who are telling the stories, those to be the people who are creating things. So like it has this 1-2 punch of change being a very difficult and long process. And we all hopefully continue to do better at figuring out empathy and figuring out how not to, you know, how to look outside of our privilege and to be able to experience what other people are experiencing.
It's like everyone has pain and trauma and you either turn that into empathy or you turn it into anger.
And sure.
It's hard to go from, I used to say, I knew a guy who was recently divorced, who everybody said they had just been madly in love. And he was so angry at this woman. Inappropriate ringtones on his phone for when she would call and just the way he would talk about her. And I decided at that time in my life that love and hate are flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
They come from the same place or passion. Anyway, correct. I was just
they're not opposites. They are they're the same thing channeled differently, right?
Yes. Yes.
The opposite of love and hate is apathy, right? Like that's the opposite. Any. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first time I'd come into like really close contact with like a bitter divorcee. You know, because in my head, growing up, divorce was rare enough where I lived that I just assumed, you know, well, everybody still, you know, likes each other, still pleasant to each other. And I'm probably more often the case that it's the opposite of that. He was so bitter. I don't think he is anymore, but yeah.
Yeah.
If their love turned to hate like that, we're not on the same team anymore. Fuck you. Any chatters today? Hey, we got chatters.
We got chatters.